Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed Towards Justice. I'm here, as always, with my colleague, Colin Miller. Hey, Colin, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm good. We have some guests on that I'm very excited to have on because they are attorneys for a defendant whose case we've been following for many years and, in fact, even considered having on as one of our full undisclosed seasons. But the reason we didn't was because we're hoping he wouldn't need it eventually. Anyhow, I want to welcome on to the show attorneys Eamon Joyce and Brian Howe. Welcome to Undisclosed, guys.
Thanks, Rabia.
Great to be here.
Eamon and Brian represent Tyrone Noling, which for anybody who is, you know, kind of familiar with the world of innocence and wrongful convictions should be a fairly recognizable name. Tyrone's case has been covered in a lot of different media, but it is not a case, I don't think, Colin, we've ever discussed on the show in all these years. We never have we?
No.
So, Brian, Eamon, I'm going to turn it over to you to just kind of give our listeners the basic facts of the case. Brian, how long have you been on the case, by the way?
So my involvement with the case started in 2017. And at that point, I was one of the members of the team litigating, seeking DNA testing on some items that were physical evidence recovered from the scene. And so that's been, it's been about 10 years for me.
About 10 years. And Eamon?
We were just trying to piece together this history, Rabia. It's either 2019 or 2020 for me.
Okay. But the case goes back much further than even that, I believe. So I'm going to turn it over to whichever one of you wants to kind of brief us on the facts of the case, the underlying crime, how Tyrone was picked up for it.
No one's better at doing that than Brian. So
all right, Brian, the floor is yours.
This was in 1990, small town in rural Northeast Ohio. Someone had gone into an elderly couple's home, Bernard and Cora Hardig, and shot them 10 times with a small caliber pistol. And they were discovered a few days later. This is a very, very small town in Portage County, Ohio. This was big news. This was a big deal. And the sheriff's detectives began investigating, you know, looking for potential suspects. The case remained open for over a year. At some point, the prosecutor's office took over the investigation, which was actually fairly unusual for the time, but ultimately indicted four people connected with the crime, including Tyrone Noling. Tyrone was convicted and sentenced to death for allegedly taking part in those murders.
And Tyrone has always maintained his innocence, that's right?
Always 100% maintained his innocence in the case.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, do you think having the prosecutor take over the investigation, was that because it was just a small town, the police were not able, didn't have the resources to do it? Or was it a political move? How did that happen?
So, you know, it appears to be, you know, from looking through the files, which we've had a chance to do over the last few years, we've had access to now recently both the sheriff's file and the prosecutor's file. You know, we're piecing it together from the outside, but the way that it looks from our vantage point is the sheriff's detectives had a few suspects early on. There was one person who had literally, while the detectives were at the scene processing the initial scene, they got a report in that someone had reported a 25 caliber pistol missing at a roller skating rink that was less than a mile away. Right. And they were being very suspicious. They had gone in and said, I think I lost a 25 caliber pistol. I'm not really sure. I don't want a kid to pick it up. You know, have you guys seen anything like this to the employees at the roller skating rink? As the detectives are processing this murder scene that was committed with 25 caliber pistol. So police are very interested in that. They end up tracing this back to a person named Dennis Van Steenberg. And they ask Mr. Van Steenberg, where is this 25 caliber pistol? There was someone who was, you know, this couple, elderly couple was just murdered with a 25. We want to be able to see that and compare it to the murder. So he sort of hedges for a couple of days, eventually gives them a 25 caliber pistol, and they eliminate it. In fact, one of the things that we've discovered in the file since we've had access to it is that the gun that he gave to police for them to use in the comparison was actually not the one that he had had in his own possession. It was something that he had gotten through his relatives from, I think it was an uncle. And he basically told these family members, well, I can't give them the actual 25, So I need another gun to give them. I need another 25 caliber pistol to give the police. And he had gotten this through family.
I have so many questions already.
we haven't even specialized, Rabia. We're just getting started. This is the.
But is this suspect the same man who said I lost my gun at a roller skating rink? Same guy.
Yeah, it was connected to that. The person who had actually gone to the roller skating rink was told by that person to go and look for it.
And how did the police find out that he got another gun from family? Was that like just in the police files? Like, how did they learn that information?
It was reported to sheriff's detectives by actually a member of that person's family who said, you know, I understand that you guys were trying to find Dennis's, you know, 25 caliber pistol. You all should know that his dad came and got a 25 from, you know, his uncle. And that was the one that he turned into you all. That was never disclosed.
They knew it during the initial investigation, but it was never disclosed.
Correct. Am I right? 2009, about two decades after the crime, there's this public records request, and that's where this documentation finally comes to light, right?
Yeah, we're still litigating. There's a lot of things that were discovered by the defense for the first time as a result of public records requests around 2009. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Statement itself, though, is April of 1991.
Right.
Wow. Okay, so they've got the suspect. He looks, you know, good for this, at least very highly suspicious. How is he one of the four that's indicted?
No. Okay. In fact, the police don't seem to do any additional follow-up, at least that we've had, even after having been told that basically Van Steenburgh had given them a false gun from the one that they were looking for. That doesn't appear to have been followed up by anyone, either the sheriff's detectives or the prosecutor's office. He is one of the initial suspects in the case. There's another suspect, actually. This is also something that was not known to the defense at the time. But just days after the murder, at a nearby high school, someone reports, and it gets taken up to the vice principal, that their brother confessed to having murdered the old couple in Atwater. The vice principal or the principal reports that to sheriff's detectives. Sheriff detectives go out to the address, and when they get to the address, they don't actually ever talk to the student who had initially done the report, but they talk to that student's sort of foster mother. He's living at a place that's fostering, you know, a few children at a time. The foster mother says, the student's brother is this other 14-year-old, and the police just don't think it's very credible that the 14-year-old would have done it, and they don't investigate further. They never talk to the principal. They never talk to the actual student. So they don't follow up on this alleged confession at all. They think it's sort of a dry lead. What happens is within a couple of years, I could get the exact date, there's a very, very gruesome murder in a few counties over in Ashtabula County committed by a man named Dan Wilson. And he basically attacks a woman, puts her in the trunk of a car, and sets the car on fire.
Oh my God.
The police believe that he is responsible for other murders in the area, or at least they're investigating other murders in the area. And so they start going back at places where Dan Wilson had lived earlier. And it turns out he was living at the same foster home. And it turns out this foster home is very, very close to the place where the Hardings were murdered. This is a place, remember, where there's not really much close at all. This is the middle of, you know, I mean, there's hardly anything within a mile of the house. And this foster house is one of them.
Was this crime considered a robbery? Like, what was the motive that they established?
Yeah, it's a great question. Eamon, do you want to?
Yeah, it's interesting because it doesn't set up like a traditional robbery at all. The hard eggs were found in a way that suggested that they either knew the perpetrator or at least had some low-level interaction with the perpetrator.
Can you explain that a little bit? Like, why do they think that?
Because it looked like they were sitting down.
Like they had let somebody in. Okay.
Exactly. Let somebody in, not forced entry, and were positioned in a way that they seemingly had been engaged with the ultimate perpetrator and not from defensive positions. And yet, when the prosecutor's office begins to focus on Noling and the other individuals, they treat it like a robbery. They kind of went after these fairly small-time teenagers who had done some minor nonviolent crimes and kind of in some ways mapped that motive, right? Stealing VCRs or stealing, you know, small-time crimes onto this offense, which otherwise didn't look anything like it. The Hardig,
nothing was missing.
Right. The Hardig's home had not been cleared out. The Hardig's did not look surprised by what had occurred. Brian, I'm not sure if you have anything to add there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things from the scene that are inconsistent with the robbery, right? There are also some other things that are interesting and that may point towards other suspects. One of the things that the perpetrator spent a lot of time on was a metal lockbox that contained paperwork. It was just full of documents. And that doesn't seem to be consistent with anything that, these sort of teenagers who are supposedly out looking for VCRs to pawn, would have cared much about. But it does line up pretty neatly with another one of the suspects that the sheriffs were investigating at the time.
So there was a lockbox that somebody attempted to pry open, wasn't able to do so.
They had opened this box and it was full of paperwork and it appeared, I think, I'm going off of the description that the sheriffs had offered at the mm-hmm. time, but it appeared that someone had sort of rummaged through these documents looking for something. You know, you could just go on and on. There's one more interesting suspect here that was a subject of the original investigation. The last person that was known to have talked to the Hardigs alive was their doctor. And their doctor had talked to them over the phone a few days earlier. And at that point, Bernard Hardig had said, there's something fishy going on. I had loaned this insurance salesman $10,000. And he said he was going to pay me back when this certificate of deposit came due. And that was supposed to be on April 1st. And it's now well past that. And something fishy's going on. And I'm really going to get to the bottom of this. That was the last conversation that police were able to say for sure happened while the Hardigs were alive. The insurance salesman, or at least one of the insurance salesmen that the police had talked to, did own a 25 caliber pistol. It was the type of 25 caliber pistol that was consistent with the general characteristics found on the bullets recovered from the murder scene. And this person sort of refused to take a lie detector test, lawyered up very quickly, refused to cooperate in the investigation. And shortly after police sort of started focusing on him, the prosecutor's office took over the investigation. It appears, again, that there was never any additional investigation into that suspect.
He wasn't cleared necessarily. They just kind of moved along.
Yeah, he had told police he didn't want to talk further without a lawyer. He had refused to take a lie detector test. And at that point, it was right around then that the prosecutor's office took over the investigation. From what we see of the prosecutor's file, it appears that their sole focus was on Tyrone Nolan and the co-defendants at that point.
Have you ever noticed your dog doing something that you thought was kind of funny and you brushed off, you know, maybe like they're scratching or licking their paws, shaking their head, but then it kind of continues to go on and you realize, oh, maybe there's something wrong and you try to figure it out? Well, my experience is, and I say this as the daughter of a veterinarian who spent, I don't know, 2 decades in that veterinary clinic with my dad, is that a lot of dogs tend to itch, scratch, rub, eat grass, do all kinds of odd behaviors. Some of them are prone to ear infections. You know, they've got diarrhea, poor digestion, like all these kinds of symptoms of things that are actually signs of allergies and people don't realize it. And what I've learned is that allergies in dogs often start in the gut. When things get out of balance internally, it can show up everywhere in issues with their skin, ears, digestion, and energy. Like us, dogs need good bacteria to strengthen their gut health and calm an overactive immune system. That's where Better Wild Allergy Relief Soft Chews come in. They are designed to support your pet's allergy defenses by strengthening digestion and helping restore balance from the inside. They are the first and only chew with something called Ancestral Advantage Wolf Probiotics and natural ingredients proven to help reduce itching and support gut, immune, and skin health. So instead of just covering things up or addressing symptoms, you're actually supporting your dog at the source. And right now, I know we are deep in allergy season, so this is the time to start supplementing your dog's health with Better Wild Allergy Relief Soft Chews. Better Wild is committed to helping your dogs with clinically proven, veterinarian-approved solutions that you can feel great about. Right now, Better Wild is offering our listeners up to 40% off your order at betterwild.com/justice. That's betterwild.com/justice for up to 40% off your order. betterwild.com/justice. I mean, given it's such a small rural town, they are rich with suspects. It feels like a lot of really good alternate suspects. How did Tyrone Noling get in their target? Like, how did he get involved in any of this? Like, where did his name come up? Did somebody name him?
Around the time of that the Hardings were murdered, this county over in Stark County, Tyrone and his other sort of three co-defendants were basically unsupervised teenagers living in a house in Alliance, Ohio. And they were committing small crimes throughout Alliance. They were breaking into cars. The two sort of most serious things that they did were things where they had gone up to a house and knocked on the door, got an entry into the house, and then sort of they had a unloaded shotgun and a fake 38 caliber pistol. And they used that to hold people up as they sort of rob people of VCRs and jewelry and things like that. In one of those robberies, in the second robbery, they had taken a 25 caliber pistol from a home that they had gone into. And so you can see sort of why police were very interested in this at first. It seems like, oh, there was a robbery. They had just gotten a 25 caliber pistol. This was the first sort of working weapon that they'd actually had the entire time. Maybe this is connected. So they were investigated. Police actually recovered the 25 caliber pistol that was stolen from the robbery, and it was excluded. It did not match. It was not the weapon used in the murder. And at that point, the sheriff's detective seemed to have pretty much lost interest in Noling and his co-defendants as suspects, right? And there's also things where it doesn't quite match up, right? The other things that were happening were all just within walking distance of this house. They would run through the woods.
I seem to remember that detail, that it was like they were just going in the neighborhood, through the neighborhood. And yeah.
You know, I don't want to undermine the seriousness of that, but, you know, they were teenagers. They would run out of the back of the house through the woods, and they would find sort of, you know, petty things to do in the neighborhood and cause trouble. The Hardings were murdered, it's a 20-minute drive away down this very small, isolated rural road. It's not the kind of place that you just stumble upon by driving around. And it's really sort of inconsistent in terms of the area that it was happening with the rest of this. So there are reasons that the original sheriff's detectives decided that they were not their prime suspect. And in fact, even the elected sheriff at the time has said Noling was not a suspect that they thought was plausible back during the original investigation. And it wasn't until the prosecutor's office took over the investigation that Noling became the prime targets.
Let me layer one more on there. In the mix of all this, Noling passes a lie detector test. So if you think about the through lines, right, the motive that they thought maybe Noling and his co-small-time offenders had done, right, was a robbery. And yet the Hardings are found with their jewelry on, with their wallets, with all the things you would expect these small-time criminals to have taken, not to have taken. The 25, which is this through line across suspects, doesn't match. And Noling takes and passes a lie detector test. So there's really nothing to go on for either the sheriff's department or the prosecutor. And look, as a result of, or in those combination of things, even the prosecutor ends up dropping the charges against Mr. Noling after bringing them, drops them in mid-1993.
Oh, okay. So can we talk a little bit about that, the procedural history here? So Tyrone is booked on these charges, but then they're actually dropped and then he's recharged. Can you explain this?
Sure. And as courts have summarized, back in August of 1995, after having had those charges dropped, Mr. Noling gets reindicted when, quoting the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, when a new local prosecutor took office, right? This is, as Brian said, a big crime, a high-profile crime, and a local prosecutor took office, and notwithstanding all the directions in which the evidence pointed, and without any physical evidence linking Noling to the crime, instead decides to go forward. And basically, at that point, all the prosecutor has is some statements by Mr. Noling's alleged accomplices and co-defendants. And I think that's a good place to pass back to Brian, who knows those statements and the investigator better than anybody.
And those co-defendants are the same kids he's running around with, he lives with. Is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Brian, what did they say?
What appears to happen, and again, I mean, you know, we've only recently gotten access to the complete prosecutor's file, but what appears to have happened when the prosecutor's office took over investigation was they started with the youngest of these teenagers, who was Butch Wolcott. He was 14 in 1990. He was 16 during the initial interview with an investigator named Ron Craig. And this is an investigator that is, you know, alleged to have had, or who is known for sort of, I guess, getting results, in maybe an aggressive way, is one way to say it. One of the things that happened in this case is, well, initially Butch denies any involvement. Like everyone else, I have no idea. He never, you know, admits readily the other kind of small time, petty crimes that they had taken part in, but denies ever taking part in a murder. That's not really accepted as an answer. And it gets to the point where he's actually even taken to a psychologist who convinces him that he has repressed memories.
Taken to the psychologist, to be clear, by the investigator.
By the investigator. That's right. The psychologist who is brought in by the investigator convinces Butch that he must have repressed memory of having committed the murder, and that you know, maybe visiting the scene or things like that will help jog his memory. And so that's exactly what happens. You know, you bring this child out to the scene and convince him that he must have blocked from his mind his involvement in the murder, and convince him that he did actually take part in it. So it's not long before they eventually get him to admit his involvement, supposedly, in the crime. Now, he doesn't know any details, and his first initial statements are full of things like, you know, was it night or was it day? Well, it was kind of day and kind of night, you know, maybe something in between. Was it an asphalt driveway or a gravel drive? Well, maybe it was a little asphalt and a little drive, you know, gravel. It's exactly the kind of equivocating that you would expect from a kid who's just making this up. But that is basically the toehold through which the rest of the teenagers are flipped. And they use Butch's, you know, statement to then get a statement from another teenager, Joey D'Alessandro. Then those two are used to get statements against Gary St. Clair. And then the three of them are used against Tyrone Nolan. Gary St. Clair recants before they even get to the original trial. You know, they're all originally offered some sort of deal in exchange, except for Tyrone. They're all offered deals, sort of flipping up their way to with Tyrone as apparently the main target.
Was he the oldest? I'm wondering why he was the main target.
I don't know if he was the oldest, and I'm not sure why he was the main target. But it appears from the beginning that was the end game for investigators.
Yeah, it might have been because he was the least likely to flip. It seems like if he maintained his innocence the entire time, they couldn't get him to, they couldn't break him.
Yeah.
And so, Brian, you noted that one of these teenagers recants before we have the conviction. The other two who testify against him at trial, what do they later say after they testify and help to secure his conviction?
I think it's fairly quickly that all three are recanting. And all three say similar things. They felt bullied by the investigator. You know, Butch especially talks, I think, about how difficult that process was for him and how sort of traumatizing it was being, for all intents and purposes, bullied by the investigator. But they all eventually say the same thing. They were scared. They falsely claimed to have something to do with this in order to try to save themselves in some way, either from the interrogation or for, you know, consequences that were being threatened.
And let me just add a little bit, right? St. Clair, because I think you only see this on Law and Order, right? It just doesn't happen in cases. St. Clair recants on the witness stand, and the prosecution, in a classic, right, Law and Order moment, never happens to those of us who do real cases, asks for permission to treat him as hostile and gets to treat their own witness as hostile on the witness stand. So this case, which starts without physical evidence, which starts with just these inculpating statements and kind of half-baked case based on recalled memories, is unraveling in real time.
But the jury buys it.
The jury buys it.
Were all the defendants convicted? Or did the other three get deals? Like what? And what happened to their deals if they're recanting?
All deal.
Butch was offered complete immunity, you know, as the first one and as the youngest. Basically, he faced no consequences, at least legally, for, you know, in exchange for his cooperation. He's faced a lot of consequences, I think, in terms of the trauma of what he went through, but he didn't face any legal consequences. There were deals offered for D'Alessandro, and I believe there were deals originally offered for St. Clair, but the only one who actually went to trial was Tyrone. So the rest took some sort of, for those who were charged in connection with this, the only trial was Tyrone's.
And if we're laying this out, just so the listeners know they're getting the whole story, we have the one recanting co-defendant on the witness stand at trial. We have the other two who testify and later recant after conviction. Is there anything else at the trial that might have moved the needle for the jury finding Tyrone guilty, or is it literally just the testimony by these two co-defendants?
In my view, it's really just the testimony by the co-defendants and kind of square peg round hole of petty crimes and another offense, right? I've heard prosecutors and defense attorneys both talk about this dynamic, right? Cases in the early 90s, jurors probably were looking for something different than they were, would be today or would be even by the mid 90s, right? When you get to the CSI-ification of trial, you could imagine this trial happening several years later and the jury just thinking, wait a second, the 25 doesn't match? We're done here. But in some ways, I just chalk this up to a different era and a jury that probably trusted to a considerable degree the prosecutor's office in this small community.
How did the state allege that these kids got to the house? I'm assuming none of them had a car. They walked 20 miles? Like, what was the theory here?
I believe one of them did have a car. And so there was, you know, the police sort of drove them around and got Butch, I believe, to say, oh, we turned here and then we turned here and then we turned here and then we turned here. But even you can sort of see in the process, you know, they start getting close to the house and they have to sort of, they're ostensibly taking direction from Butch, but they have to really, you know, slow down. Slow down. And exactly. I mean, you know, there's a lot of suggestion happening, you know, so they do have a car. The other incidents that prosecutors say are sort of part of the same pattern. None of them involve driving 20 minutes out to some random, you know, small county road in the middle of nowhere. They were all just running through the neighborhood, basically. So, you know, that alone sort of already breaks with what the state is claiming this pattern is.
Yeah, and I think it's Joey D'Alessandro had the car, and it was blue, which I think the jury got that evidence because there was a statement shortly after the crime, can't recall who made it, where someone noted that they had seen a blue car in the area, potentially leaving the area. Funny set of coincidences, putting aside the prevalence of blue cars all across the country. Dan Wilson also had a blue car. There's also some evidence that the insurance agent that Brian mentioned earlier had a blue car. So even if you put some stock in blue car, despite its prevalence, it doesn't exactly zero in on these petty criminals, even if, you know, D'Alessandro too had a blue one.
Yeah, and if we go back then to Dan Wilson, we discussed earlier that 2009 public records request and some of the things that were finally revealed decades later. Another thing in that records request relates to testing of a cigarette butt that was found at the crime scene. So you can let us know what they found with regard to that cigarette butt and what that testing of that butt found.
Yeah. Eamon, do you want...
Definitely as the DNA guy, the Innocence Project, you should be all over this one, sir.
Sure. So, you know, one of the things that was interesting when we looked through the initial investigation was that, you know, first of all, you do have a tip that could have connected police to Dan Wilson before he had killed this other woman in Ashtabula, right? Mm-hmm. There was his foster brother who had heard him confess, if anyone had bothered to go talk to the foster brother, they would have known that Dan Wilson was the one who confessed to his foster brother that he had killed the Hardings. Because of his confession to his stepbrother and because of his involvement, you know, once they realized that they had actually been informed of this confession to the stepbrother, and they started going back through and seeing if he was a viable suspect, one of the things that they noted, they had recovered a cigarette butt from the crime scene. And they thought this was interesting because the Hardings did not smoke. The Hardings were fastidious people. The Hardings were, you know, the sort of to trim grass with sort of a pair of scissors level of neat. And here's the cigarette butt in the middle of the driveway. So they did very rudimentary DNA testing on comparing it to Tyrone and all of his three co-defendants. And every one of them was excluded. So what they didn't do was compare it to anyone else, but they took the time to note that the person who had smoked, in terms of serology, the person who had left the cigarette was likely a non-secretor. And they noted in that same report that we believe was not turned over to the defense that Dan Wilson is a type A non-secretor. So having just eliminated Tyrone and all of his co-defendants, having just discovered that this is a person who credibly confessed to his stepbrother that he committed the murder. Police are noting that he is a possible contributor to the cigarette butt, and they decide to stop there and not do any further testing.
And when you say that he is a non-secretor, statistically, how significant is that in this context?
It's not DNA. I mean, to be fair, you know, DNA is very, can discern, you know, to parts in millions, billions, quadrillions. Anytime you get into serology, you're talking, you know, significant percentages of the population. I don't know what percentage is non-secretor, but I don't believe it's a majority. Just to note, you know, if it was super commonplace, presumably you wouldn't say anything about it at all. What's interesting is that the investigators say this person was a non-secretor who left the cigarette butt, and Dan Wilson is a non-secretor. They didn't list sort of everyone in the world who was a non-secretor. They noted that this person who's just killed another person, who actually had an incident earlier in his life where he'd broken into an elderly person's home and attacked that person, that this person was a non-secretor as well. And so that's the fact that wasn't turned over to the defense, along with this initial confession that the police seem to have missed. That was not turned over to defense at the time of trial, we believe. One of the most frustrating things to me about this case is that there is physical evidence. You know, when we say that there's no physical evidence, there's no physical evidence that implicated Tyrone. There was physical evidence that was touched by the perpetrator. Mm. There is physical evidence that was touched by the perpetrator that was recovered from the scene and that has never been tested. You know, it's frustrating that here we have a person sitting on death row for 30 years with all of this evidence in his favor. And a person just with the snap of their fingers could get physical evidence tested that could settle the matter once and for all. You know, I mean, and there have been concerns raised about contamination and what were the methods that items were collected in 1990. You know, if Dan Wilson's DNA is on these 10 casings that were recovered right from the scene, it didn't get there from contamination. Right. If the insurance salesman's DNA is on these casings, it didn't get there from contamination. We could resolve this definitively with physical evidence.
Are those two suspects still around? Are they alive?
All of the alternate suspects in this case are deceased.
Robbie, it should be noted that the state put Dan Wilson to death. After that other murder that Brian mentioned, he was tried and convicted of capital offense, and then the state, in fact, executed him. So as I was saying to Brian earlier, in some ways in my brain, the evidence falls into two buckets, right? We've got this bucket of all these things that, in our view, excludes Tyrone without a shadow mm-hmm. of a doubt. Mm-hmm. Now you've got this other evidence that they haven't tested where maybe that evidence would show you who did this crime, right? Maybe it would bring some peace to this community to know who the actual offender is.
And you have or have not petitioned the court to have the evidence tested?
We have.
And okay, compared to those two suspects, you have. Okay.
Yes. And so far, the response has been opposition, that, you know, that the state has opposed, you know, has not been neutral about has not been in favor of testing this evidence, has not been neutral about whether it should be tested, even when we're offering to test it at our own expense, pursuant to some rules that have been recently promulgated that should allow us physical access to evidence. The response has been opposition, that no one should know whose DNA is on these casings. We don't want to know. We don't want anyone to know. We don't want you to know. And that's really hard to accept with the stakes being what they are.
So a profile has been created from that physical evidence that was compared to Tyrone. Am I understanding that correct? And then did not match Tyrone. Is that right? Or a profile has never even been created from the evidence?
There are multiple things that were collected at the time. The cigarette butt was sort of the easiest to test, right? Because, you know, as you know, cigarette butts are prime sources for DNA. There's something that, you know, has been in someone's mouth. It tends to be a pretty good source of DNA. Even back in the early 90s, they tried using primitive DNA testing to compare the cigarette butt to Noling and his co-defendants. And even then, they knew that he was excluded from all of those. They did not compare him to Dan Wilson. They knew at the time that Dan Wilson's blood typing, his serology was consistent with the cigarette butt. And that's as far as they took it. They have since done DNA testing and put the DNA profile into CODIS where Dan Wilson should be. And they're claiming that he is therefore sort of indirectly excluded by there not being a CODIS match for this. However, there are other pieces of evidence that have never been tested. There were 10 cartridge casings recovered from the crime scene. DNA testing on cartridge casings has been, very, very, very difficult historically. There are some methods that are used right now over the last 5 years that make that much more fruitful in terms of recovering DNA from the person who had loaded the weapon prior to the firing. And we've got 10 of them here. So there is a possibility that we could really recover a complete profile from the person who loaded this 25 caliber pistol. But, you know, we have to be open to trying. And right now, you know, it is, you know, Mr. Noling really, really trying hard to have more testing on this physical evidence. And, the other parties to the case very opposed to anything that would be testing on this physical evidence that could bring it to light. It's hard to understand, hard to accept.
I mean, it's not hard to understand because they don't want to be proven wrong, but I am so opposed, and I've talked about this plenty of times on podcasts, any prosecutor opposes DNA testing, there's a problem there. It just means you don't want the truth. Because what are you scared of?
As you've noted, in 2009, this open records request produces evidence connected to both Dan Wilson and Dennis Van Steenburgh, and that prompts this appeal in 2010. And the state's response is, we had open file discovery, and thereby, this is not a Brady violation. So can you tell us a bit about the state's response to this argument and how that litigation on that issue proceeds?
I think the first thing I'd say is, so the state, in this case, consistent with practice, right, used an open file that ran through the prosecutor's office. And the story was long. The prosecutor's office maintained an open file policy, and so any of these materials would have been in there. All the attorneys who'd handled this case said, we don't recall ever seeing these materials. If we had seen these materials, these are the kind of materials that we would have defended the case with. And for good reason, right? This is a purely circumstantial case, and their theories had always been that this was not committed by Noling, but the prosecution and the sheriff's office had missed suspects. So, you know, unless you believe these attorneys had completely dropped the ball, there's very strong reason to believe that had these materials been there, they would have used them. And then a very lengthy fight ensues, really close to a decade or maybe a decade of fighting with the state about whether we would get to look at these files and see what was in them. And we had an expert authorized, a document examiner, to go into the prosecution's files because the prosecution had always maintained this information was always in our files. And we had half a mind that we might find copies there. Copies that came into the file after the fact. We examined all of those files exhaustively, both through counsel and through the document examiner. And in some ways, we're all surprised to find No, there wasn't anything really to examine. The materials simply weren't there. The only versions of them that were there were the ones that Mr. Noling had filed as exhibits well after his trial. And that's all you find in the so-called open file. Now, very, very late in proceedings, in response to our most recent round of motions, the state has for the first time maintained, see, these materials, while they may not have been in the prosecution's file, open file, as we've always maintained, the sheriff had them, and the sheriff provided all those materials to trial counsel. In our view, there's absolutely no support for the notion that the sheriff provided those materials. Obviously, it's not surprising to anyone that the sheriff's file has the materials. They were found in public records requests. We know the sheriff created these materials, but there's no support to suggest that what the sheriff had, and this is typical in these cases, right? Individual notes and those kind of things stay close to the vest and are only turned over if they are exculpatory and are put in a separate Brady file. This sheriff's office record distinguishes expressly between physical evidence that was to be turned over to Mr. Noling's counsel, shell casings, that kind of thing, and the documentary evidence, which was not. And we've spoken with those trial counsel. They have attested that when they went to the sheriff's office, they did not see these materials, did not have access to everything that the sheriff had. Instead, were there to see what the physical evidence was as opposed to the documentary evidence.
Got it. And so you mentioned this most recent round of filings. And so Tyrone remains on death row. What court is currently considering his claims, and when is the next either hearing or ruling by the judge expected?
So we are back in the Court of Common Pleas for Portage County, Ohio. The court, based on our motion for leave to file a motion for a new trial and our motion for a new trial, has ordered that an evidentiary hearing be set. That has not been scheduled yet. We're hopeful that it'll take place this summer. And the case, maybe this is implicit in what we've said before, the case returns to that court because we won a series of victories between an appellate court called the 11th District that instructed the Court of Common Pleas to take more evidence on whether, in fact, these materials were in the prosecution's open file. We think we've shown they were not in the prosecution's open file, and now there's this narrow question about did the sheriff's file somehow get turned over to the trial lawyers?
Yeah. I think just two final questions. The first being, there's a juror who presided in Tyrone's case and obviously found him guilty. She has now come forward, and what has she said about her stance on the case?
The first thing to note about that juror is, even before a lot of this evidence came out, she came forward with her doubts, right? She's been talking about her doubts in the case for well more than a decade, going back to, I believe, 2012, about concerns she had about the case. And I would say her doubts have only expanded as more evidence has come out. And from my standpoint, what is most remarkable about that, right? Jurors don't generally come forward after cases that they've struggled with, but the way it fits a pattern, right? You have, as Brian mentioned earlier, the sheriff who presided over this department saying, this doesn't make sense. A juror who sat on the case saying, this doesn't make sense. And really no one other than, in my view, the prosecutors who are no longer in that office really standing up to say, this makes sense, because there just is not a through line or a narrative with which you can say in logical terms how Mr. Noling is guilty of this crime or is anything but innocent of this crime. But I'll defer to Brian for more detail on the juror who he's had interactions with.
I don't think I could say it better than that. It's just very unusual for a juror to come forward having, you know, taken part in the case originally, having voted to convict, having voted to sentence Tyrone to death, and come back not only, you know, with doubts about the death sentence, which does happen, but doubts about the veracity of the conviction, that maybe we got the wrong person. I mean, you know, it doesn't so much have a place in the legal proceedings, but it's just unusual. And it's striking. And as Eamon said, it matches with everything else. I think everyone looking into this case in 2026 should have doubts about Tyrone's guilt. And in fact, to me, the evidence best lines up with him being completely 100% innocent.
My final question is, you both obviously have worked in this case for a number of years and interacted with Tyrone, who, as you just said, you believe was wrongfully convicted and is on death row all these years later. Can you let our listeners know what Tyrone is like and what his life has been like in prison and on death row for these decades as, again, a person you believe to be actually innocent?
So one of the things I'll say, having represented other individuals on death row, some of whom have maintained their innocence all along, others of whom are fighting sentence only, Tyrone in some ways has been fortunate in that he has family support and a whole league of supporters, people who have gotten to know him over the years. And that's powerful, right? Many people, look, our prison systems and particularly death row are populated by folks who often lack family connections. Their families are far away. Their families kind of break off ties. And when you think about Tyrone, who's been incarcerated since he was a very young man, right? We change as adults and it's hard to maintain relationships. Tyrone is really fortunate to have kept up relationships and to have had relationships that have grown and people who have turned into his advocates. So I like to think, and I hope that gives Tyrone more strength than it would many people who have the fortune to have on death row. But at the same time, Tyrone remains really frustrated. This is very frustrating for somebody who is in a really scary situation as a young person, right? Having the police bear down on them when he's saying from the jump, this is crazy. I had nothing to do with this. And piece of evidence after piece of evidence comes out that makes this seem even crazier. And yet here he still is. And so that's hard. And that definitely wears on Tyrone. Nothing would make me happier than one of two things. One, we win this case going away. But what would make me even happier yet is if a prosecutor new to that office would say, this is just wrong. Mm-hmm. And we are not going to do this anymore. This case never should have been brought to trial, never should have led to an indictment of Mr. Noling. But what we know now in 2026 is that Mr. Noling is not good for this crime and we are not doing this anymore, right? That, from my standpoint, is one of the obligations of prosecutors. And they've got a chance to make it partially right after all these years, and we'd really like to see that happen. We'll litigate this thing until we've got no options left, but I'd like to think that there's an off-ramp.
Does this prosecutor's office have a conviction integrity unit?
Not to my knowledge.
No. And they just have not been at all, like, open to considering, I mean, like, outside of court, you know, conversations about, like, look at all, like, you know, the evidence we've gathered, the things we've discovered, the Bradys, all the, like, they haven't been open to that at all.
So, Robbie, one of the hard things here, right, has been, I think, personalities, right? When I mentioned this long ago federal court decision noting that the prosecution decided to re-indict Noling or re-pursue Noling when a new prosecutor took office, that new prosecutor stayed in office for decades.
Oh.
And
it becomes personal.
Look, it becomes personal, yeah. And look, it's hard for anybody to admit their own mistakes. But I think for some people, it's harder than others. We've recently had a regime change in that office through retirement. And, you know, I think that gives both me and Brian a sliver, a slice of hope. I don't know that Tyrone's got the same hope. I think he thinks the prosecutors will remain dead set against him, whatever the evidence is. I like to think that there are bigger people now there, or there will be bigger people there someday.
And I'm assuming this is not an elected position.
It is an elected position.
It is an elected position. So have you guys considered a political attack on the office, getting the right candidate, running the right person, challenging on that? I mean,
we've never been in the politics directly. I think on Tyrone's behalf, we've been outspoken in the media and supportive of Tyrone's efforts to shine light on this publicly. You know, Tyrone and friends and family of his have really sought to keep a lens on this within the community, putting up billboards, for instance, for information about the crime, and speaking up to the local media often about what they see as the injustices of the prosecution's position over the years.
Yeah. I mean, because look, the Adnan Syed case was very much a campaign issue in every election cycle for the DA's office in Baltimore City. And so I've seen how it can play out for better or worse. And sometimes it's like the only thing that does work because you can't get the needle to move any other way. Brian Amon, thank you guys so much for joining us today. And I wanted, on behalf of the listeners, to ask, what can our listeners do? How can they support Tyrone? Is there, you know, I don't know, is there a petition? Is there a GoFundMe? Is there an email? Does he want to be written to? Do you want phone calls to the DA's office? Like, what could our listeners do if they really want to help here?
Sure. There is a petition asking for the governor of the state of Ohio, who's about to leave office, to free him and recognize his innocence. That is available online. I can get you the link for that.
Sure, we'll share the link. Yep.
You know, otherwise, again, there's a groundswell of support, I think, for Tyrone locally and in Ohio. And that groundswell comes from people talking to each other about this case and sharing what they've heard and learned. So if for folks who are local, for folks who are familiar with this part of Ohio, spreading the word is I think, really important. And I think that light is the best disinfectant for injustices like this. And I appreciate you all paying attention to this case and the light and attention that you can bring to it, because it does matter. It does matter for him.
Amon, is there a website, or is it just through the Innocence Project that folks can get information about the case?
Both through the Tyrone Noling website, through the Innocence Project is another avenue. And then, you know, going to media and just in broadcasting, whether through X or through other channels, Tyrone, I think, gets hope and gets strength from the fact that people are talking about his case and are paying attention.
Okay. Thank you again, Brian and Amon, and give our support and regards to Tyrone, and tell him that, you know, we want to continue to follow the case. Anything we can do, our audience can do, you know, we work with some great investigators as well. You know, you need trash pulled in the middle of the night, we can do that. We've got genetic genealogists, we know. We've got an incredible network, which I'm sure you do as well, Brian, but we're here to support in any way we can.
Thank you so much.
Thank you really so much. And I have to say just so sincerely how much this matters to Tyrone and how important this specifically is to him. I mean, you know, he was very interested and very excited to hear that we were talking to you. And, you know, he's just, it really, I think, gives him some hope. And so thank you for talking about this story.
All right. Thank you guys so much. All right. You have a good rest of the week.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. It's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/toward justice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions, because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, You can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.